You're now listening to The Brian Callen Show, considered the hottest podcast in the universe by Martians. Now get ready for the heat. Here's Brian Callen.
All right, everybody, this is Brian Callen, and this was Man Thoughts, the podcast, but we've decided that's a little cheesy, and I'm going back to the Brian Callen Show.
Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, and go to audiblepodcast.com/BCS, which stands for The Brian Callen Show, to download your free book right now, audiblepodcast.com/BCS.
And you can follow me on Twitter at Brian Callen. You can like us on Facebook. This is all my producer. I'm not even sure what like us means. But go to facebook.com/Brian Callen Comedy. Go to briancallen.com for all past episodes. And support the show by clicking on the Amazon banners. And I tracked Christy down because she wrote an amazing article that I've probably read four times in the Sunday section of the New York Times. What was it, a week ago, Christy?
Yeah, it was almost 2 weeks now.
Okay, yeah, it was almost 2 weeks ago, and it was called How to Live Without Irony. And I kind of just read it by accident. I thought it was kind of a neat title. And you know you've already had quite a backlash, positive and negative, which is always a good sign, I think, when you're a thinker. But before we get into what the article is about, what was fascinating to me is that I read this article and it articulated so well the things I felt and been frustrated by but have not been able to articulate. It was just sort of it reminds me so much of how important it is to get to the root of what bothers you. It's very difficult to kind of isolate what a problem is. It's very difficult to kind of give voice to what the root sort of aggravation, the root issue is. And I think that's a very important thing as you get older to really kind of figure out. What kills me is that I think you're 10 years younger. You're 35?
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You're 35. I looked up. I thought I was expecting this kind of like, you know, curmudgeon-y professor. And then I look you up on, I Google you, and you're this striking young woman. And on top of the fact that you speak French and you write so brilliantly, it was just kind of, it really floored me. And I forwarded your article to so many people. And we'll talk about, I'll just touch on some of the concepts I thought were really interesting. You know, you basically take hipsters to task. You call what most people are doing in today's world, at least the people that I'm around and a lot of, you know, the people that I perform for, they live ironically. It's ironic living versus direct living. You call it, a lot of people, they dress in sort of clothing that harkens back to an era they didn't even live in. And they're dealing with the problem of individuality, not with concepts or ideas, but rather with things. How you dress, tattoos, piercings, affectation, if you will. Maybe you could talk a little bit about that and maybe talk about the article and what got you to write the article in the first place.
Well, I was sitting in Berlin actually over the summer, and I had been thinking about this question a lot because I spent 6 years in California and would go to San Francisco a lot and spend a lot of time in the Mission, and then now I live about an hour away from New York. So I go to the city and go to Brooklyn sometimes.
So you're around a lot of hipsters.
I am around a lot of hipsters, but to me the hipsters, and this is one thing that I think people sort of misunderstood about what I was trying to say, many people took really offense to my article and thought that I was saying that it was only about hipster bashing. Mm-hmm. And actually, I do in the very first full paragraph of the piece do a sort of caricature of the hipster, mm-hmm. and I tried to pick the most obvious and caricatural details that I could to make it very clear that it's a caricature.
Sure.
And then I make this move that many people missed. I think most people sort of, they read that paragraph and then they said, oh, this is another hipster bashing article, and they kind of turned their minds off there. But if you continue, the very next sentence that I say is, the hipster is an easy target for mockery.
Right.
However, scoffing at the hipster is only a diluted form of his own affliction.
Mm-hmm.
So the hipster is, I think, in a way, sort of less problematic because it's visually obvious. I mean, you can see the manifestation of maybe an internal state of mind. But what's sort of more problematic and even dangerous, perhaps, is this kind of unseen irony, the irony that doesn't necessarily have an explicit visual manifestation, but is sort of manifest in speech, in behavior, and clothing.
Yeah,
and other realms outside of rhetoric.
I got that, absolutely. I think what you're talking about in some ways is almost an idea. I mean, you say something. I noticed a great deal of cynicism in young people. And I think that you, and I'll paraphrase, you say a lot of people are walking around thinking that they don't have anything to offer their culture. And they believe that any idea they have will be consumed by a different idea, a better idea, or whatever it is. So it's sort of this nihilistic sort of, what's the point of doing anything? What's the point of actually laying down my stake and formulating a bedrock of philosophical and political ideas that I can moor to when in fact there's nothing to moor to? Isn't that what you're talking about?
Exactly. I mean, this is a debate that's been going on definitely in the academy for at least 20 years or so, probably longer, but then also in, you know, sort of public discourse, this idea of the postmodern and what is our place after everything's been done? Are we simply just reconfiguring every idea that ever existed? Is it possible to know something new or discover something that hasn't already been discovered? And one thing that I want to make clear is that I talk a little bit about my position in the question because I'm a Gen Xer, I consider myself pretty solidly Gen X. But I still also have these ironic tendencies. And I think if the internet had been available more widely when I was an adolescent, I think probably this ironic moment would have started sooner. There were already signs of it. I want to give two examples. Two television shows that had a really wide appeal that involved the protagonists watching things and making fun of it. And so those two shows are Beavis and Butthead. Mm-hmm. And Mystery Science Theater 3000, both of which I loved, and I watch them all the time. But
sure.
You see what I'm saying? There's this pattern there already established of young people, and in the case of Mystery Science Theater 3000, robots as well, watching cultural production of a different era. Mm. This is more so true in
you also say, though, that there's nothing wrong with irony. I mean, that, you know, dictators lack irony. I mean,
exactly,
you know,
yeah.
It's
exactly.
Not irony you're attacking. My God, I'd hate to live in a world without irony. I'm a comedian, and I make my living off it, and I live it. I live that way. A lot of my expression, my self-expression, I'm sure comes out ironic. But what I found so important about your article is that, you know, in the real world, I mean, Amos Oz, who's an Israeli writer, said he was addressing Hamas. And all of us said, well, Hamas is a terrorist organization. Hamas, and Amos Oz says, look, you can bomb Hamas if you'd like, but history would suggest that that's a very, very, precarious way of dealing with a group like Hamas. It might just make them stronger, more desperate, more resilient. He said, Hamas is an idea, and the way to beat a bad idea is with a better idea. And that really resonated with me. I've always considered the Federalist Papers, the framers of the Constitution, that was an idea. These men solved the political problem, as far as I'm concerned, and I think a lot of people would agree. And what I found so important about your article is that, you know, when you want to change something or you want to tackle a real issue, a real problem, campaign finance reform, money in politics, the financial crisis, there are a lot of things we could point to, huge subsidies to very rich factory farms, etc. A lot of things you could talk about. We have some problems, education. You know, it's very important to be direct with your ideas and to be able to defend those ideas. And the wrong ideas, when the wrong ideas win the day, people suffer and sometimes they even die, history would suggest, right? I mean, so it's very important to be honest and direct with your philosophy and to be able to back it up. And that's what I kind of appreciated about what you were saying. You know, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I feel like you were touching on that, you know, sort of like direct. We live in a society where being direct is gauche, right? I mean, it's kind of uncool. And I think sometimes in life you have to be direct. You know, you call ironic living a first world problem, a first world luxury, which I loved, because when you have enough to eat and you have a representative government and I guess things that you think and other people think don't necessarily affect your stomach and your livelihood and your very life, it's easy to be sort of on the sideline and be wry and sarcastic and ironic.
Exactly. And right. This is, I think you're totally spot on with that remark. I was so shocked when I was receiving these kind of criticisms online saying, calling me an irony hater, which is...
Talk about missing the point. Read exactly, the article again.
I know. I'm a huge fan of irony, and this is why I feel like I'm trying to kind of save irony. I mean, that sounds mm-hmm. a little bold, mm-hmm. but mm-hmm. here's the thing. Irony, I don't believe irony should be eliminated from life. My title, How to Live Without Irony, the emphasis is on the word live. So there's a difference between irony as manifest in political humor and in other kind of useful social tool. Mm-hmm. So I'm not arguing that irony should be eliminated from life, but I'm arguing the contrary thing, that now we should try to begin a sort of nuanced management of this ironic binge that we've been having. Or we could term it in another way, a kind of recalibration of our irony sensors. Mm. Because they've become overstimulated.
You're so smart.
To the point of
You're so smart. I'm sorry. I love the way... I can't take it. It's so humbling. You're so, you know, I talked to an academic like yourself, and you couch these phrases that I'm completely going to steal. I've already been quoting you and plagiarizing, you know, and I'll continue to do so.
Yeah, that's fine. That's fine. But I kind of want to get this idea out. But yeah. A lot of people wrote to me and said, well, what about Stewart and Colbert? You know, they had quite an impact, I think, in galvanizing the youth vote for both elections in 2008 and 2012. I completely agree. And I believe that Stewart and Colbert are very necessary and very important. I watch them every day when I can. But if you're sort of drowned out by the static of irony that's around, I think their political messages lose a little bit of the punch that they could have if that was the exception rather than the rule.
Mm. Well, I think that Stewart and Colbert are trying to get a point, especially Stewart. I don't find Stewart that ironic. I actually think what Stewart is he's got a strong, he believes, Jon Stewart strikes me as somebody who believes in fair play. I've watched his debates with O'Reilly, and I've read a lot of O'Reilly, and so I know his point of view, but I've watched his debates, and Jon Stewart is really, he may be funny and ironic, but he actually just believes in fair play.
Exactly. You know? And he's very sincere in the end. I think
very
that,
much so.
That's why people are drawn to it. I think people are actually sort of starved for sincerity. I think people want it.
Absolutely.
And the proof of this is that I've gotten about over 400 emails from complete strangers who just, you know, found me on the internet and wrote to me to tell me that they feel the same way. You know, I've had 16-year-old students writing to me saying how alienated they feel at school because anytime they try to express something in some kind of authentic way, they get made fun of. I think also this comment culture has something to do with it. The fact that online you can write a comment about whatever someone else's belief is, or you can make a comment on their picture, or you can make a comment on the article they wrote about irony, and you never have to be really responsible for what you say.
Right.
And I was, in a way, a bit delighted at all the flurry of comments that were on the New York Times site and just on the internet everywhere, because these comments with this very sort of scoffing and kind of juvenile tone completely confirmed my argument.
Yeah.
So I've never seen a population so willing to make the argument for me on my behalf. That's very rare.
Well, you and I'm going to get to some. I want to read just some of the things that really touched me. But you know, it reminds me. I think it was Stanley Crouch, who was a jazz historian, and I don't want to misquote him. But I remember he was comparing, or one somebody like that was comparing the rockers of the 60s and 70s, Zeppelin and Janis Joplin and Morrison and all these guys who overdosed and did a lot of drugs, and Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young and Lou Reed, and all of them got into junk, all of them got into heroin, and it really ruined this renaissance, this musical renaissance that was going on in about 68, especially in LA. Mm-hmm. And when they were doing acid and smoking weed, it seemed to not have an effect at all. And when heroin and cocaine got involved, man, everything basically went to crap. And what I think it was Stanley Crouch said, he said the difference between what these young white rockers were doing was they were emulating their heroes were these black blues players. Their heroes, they were listening to the blues. They were listening to these great, you know, Muddy Waters and all these guys, B.B. King and the people that came before them, and even the great jazz musicians, and Billie Holiday, the you know, and things. And what he said is there's a difference. Those black musicians in the 40s and the 20s and the 30s and the 40s and the 50s, and they some of them did get into heroin. But guess what? They were trying to overcome something. Mm-hmm. And when you had people like Janis Joplin, Jim Morrison, because their heroes did heroin, they were actually subscribing to a lifestyle. Mm-hmm. They were not trying to overcome something, which was racism and having to go in the back door and not being able to play for, you know, black audiences, only white audiences, and then leaving through a different entrance. That indignity, I'm not making an excuse for heroin use, but there is a difference between somebody who is trying to overcome something versus somebody who's actually subscribing to a school of cool.
Exactly. Yeah. And I have to tell you this. I among all the emails I received, I got so many from overseas. I got emails from Vietnam, from India, from Armenia, from Brazil.
Wow.
And all throughout Europe, a lot of people have written to me. And they immediately understood my point and agreed with me and said that when we look toward the United States, we see this sort of self-infantilizing population that is making this choice to do this. Now, not everywhere in the United States. I made this argument actually in the article too. It does have something to do with privilege. It's a sort of new kind of bourgeoisie.
Thank you for your French pronunciation of bourgeoisie. Yeah. The bourgeoisie. I love it.
And so whenever there's suffering in a place, irony can't really, it's sort of dissipated. I used a quote from a friend of mine that where the real imposes itself, the irony tends to dissipate.
Mm-hmm.
And so I received actually also three letters from soldiers in Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm.
And they all had a similar viewpoint that, so they're young, and they were kind of in this sort of hipster milieu before they moved to Afghanistan to, I don't know how involved they are in the conflict. I don't know exactly what their role is. But anyway, they're faced with the real every day. And they all had the same kind of perspective that once you leave the United States and take a look at it from the outside, this irony cloud becomes much more obvious.
There's no doubt. I mean, I grew up overseas until I was 14, mostly in the developing world, like Pakistan and India and Saudi Arabia and Greece and Lebanon. And I saw, when you see certain things firsthand, poverty and suffering and people who have no say in their own, in who governs them and their own lives, you realize that you get a very different perspective. You get a very different perspective.
Yes. And a woman wrote to me, I did a radio interview for a Canadian radio station, and she was driving and she said that she almost missed her turn because what I was saying really resonated with her. And she has a son who's 24 years old and he has severe cerebral palsy. And she said that, what resonated with her was that she's around young people all the time, and she has another daughter that's also quite young, so she knows her friends and such. And so she's around young people, and then she takes care of her son as well. So she said that when she goes and spends time with him, that she can see immediately this difference. And she quoted Oliver Sacks, who said that people with disabilities are condemned to be themselves. And I thought that was a really powerful thing.
Wow.
And she said that also as a caregiver, she feels very much in the same position, that because she is forced to kind of deal with this reality, that it's impossible for her to live ironically. Maybe using irony to kind of cope with the difficulty.
Using
of it.
Humor.
Yes, that's one thing.
Yeah, using humor and stuff, sure. But
yeah, but when it sort of overtakes your whole identity, that's another question.
Well, Chrissy, I think the article and your ideas are very important, not because you're not just addressing, in my opinion, I travel this country a lot just as a comic, and I don't want to, but I spend enough time around just people, it seems a fairly eclectic group of people, and I'm not trying to, you always got to be careful with saying, well, my experience, but I think that it feels as though, and I don't have any evidence to back this up, but I don't think this is just an affliction that, that the privileged have. I think that this sort of ironic living, this indirect sort of malaise, this idea that, you have nothing to offer your culture and things like that, and ideas that you have are not really going, they're not really going to be, they're not going to make any difference. That's something that's permeated American culture in general. I think that's gone through the middle class and through a lot of people that you see.
Yeah.
I wonder why. I mean, we do a lot of drinking and drugging in this country.
Mm-hmm.
I really do believe that it probably has something to do with a state of mind, you know?
Yeah, and actually one person wrote to me and had a really interesting idea about this. He was sort of trying to theorize about why this happened when it did and what's going on here. And he said that after 9/11, you know, you had this kind of weird, I mean, I think we all know about this rupture that happened. I mean, I think we could all sort of feel that things were different after that moment. And that at that point that there, I mean, and it was already sort of there in a kind of hidden way, but it came to the surface right after 9/11, this idea of a kind of self-esteem culture. So a culture that in the service of a kind of protection of your youth or of your children and a hyper kind of hovering parent attitude, that there's been this kind of self-esteem boosting moment where parents are not so critical of their children. Mm. They kind of let them do what they want. Everybody can get a trophy, and everybody can get an A, and everybody can enjoy this.
Yeah, but Barbara Enright wrote a book called Blindsided, mm-hmm. And it was about she looks at this self-help industry.
And
she said there's nothing wrong with being positive, but there is something wrong with when you're so blindly positive that you lose your ability to be critical in your thinking. I mean, you know, it's one thing to be, I'm incredibly positive and I'm going to manifest this with my positive thoughts. But, you know, no matter what I do, I'm an athletic guy, but I'm not going to run punts back in the NFL. Mm-hmm. You've got to be somewhat critical in your thinking. And she says, and, you know, she makes the argument in her book that we're basically losing the ability to do that.
Yeah, because now it seems like everyone kind of feels qualified to be a model, an actor, a comedian, a singer. So everyone kind of feels like a Renaissance person, that everything is possible, and that because you can sort of self-publish and you can get your message out without needing to go through a kind of institutionalized channel any longer, that you can do that. You can do a lot of self-promotion. But the thing is, if you never really built up that equipment that takes years to build this as a resistance against criticism, when you have to actually face real criticism or a real problem, the only way to deal with it, it seems, is this kind of ironic response, because you can always say, oh, I was just kidding, you didn't get it, if you try to make a sincere gesture and people don't like it in the end.
Well, this is why I love stand-up comedy. You're either funny or you're not. You get up on stage in Philly or New York or Pittsburgh, if you don't bring the money for an hour, you're going to die real quick, and it doesn't matter who you are. It's why I love fighting, I like dancing, I like comedy, and I like sex. You can't fake any of them. You can try to be ironic about them, but you've got to be pretty direct, and you better be good or you're going to feel it immediately. You know, I mean, it sounds silly, but it's really actually it's really. And I want to read something. You the way you couch it is so beautiful. I've already kind of paraphrased it, but it says, how did this happen? How did we start living with irony? He said, it stems in part from the belief that this generation has little to offer in terms of culture, that everything has already been done, or that serious commitment to any belief will eventually be subsumed by an opposing belief, rendering the first laughable at best and contemptible at worst. And then you say, this is great, this kind of defensive living works as a preemptive surrender and takes the form of reaction rather than action. And that really kind of was such a beautiful way of putting sort of, it felt like the core of the problem in a way, you know.
Yeah, I think so. And, you know, there's one thing that I didn't really get to talk about in that article. It's in its original instantiation, that article was twice as long, and I had to compress it into this 1800 word thing.
Right.
But there was one thing that I wanted to talk about that I haven't mentioned yet, which is this transition moment between Gen X and Gen Y, which is that emo moment. So this emo music scene. And if you remember, that coincided exactly when people were having a sort of public presence on the internet, so a sort of social networking presence. So these two things coincide. So you had this moment with the emo people involved in that scene, who I think were actually quite sincere. And I always see a lot of connections with romanticism in that sort of in that moment, but that you have these people who are being very sincere and exposing their feelings in the form of music or their response to music, and they were just ripped to pieces and made fun of on the internet, and so that immediately shut down that kind of honest expression as a possibility. When the first attempt at that gets truncated so quickly.
Well, yeah, because when you say to somebody, "I love what you do," or "I love you," you are vulnerable, man. You're opening yourself up to all. I mean, if the minute they say, you know, "Get out of here, weirdo," or whatever, you're crushed. Mm-hmm. You talk about, you know, when you are direct in how you feel about something, when you're direct with an idea, when you take the time as you have to really create an idea, it's risky. And we live in, you know, a lot of people, we have the luxury of avoiding risk. But you know, and you know, is, you know, I told you when we were talking before not to read any of the comments, because when you put an idea out like you have and done it so well in a very bold way, you're going to get a real reaction, positive and negative.
Exactly. And, you know, I kind of felt comfortable with this. I knew I was taking a risk when I published this. And I actually don't mind making myself vulnerable in that way, because I actually really believe in what I'm saying. And in academia, I mean, we have to present our ideas all the time, and at conferences, when at any moment someone could stand up and say, "Your idea is terrible, go away." I mean, this happens all the time. Or someone, I don't know, we do a lot of peer-reviewed things that are anonymous, so you send your article somewhere and you get back reader comments, and people can, of course, say whatever they want, because they're never, you never know who they are or whatever. So, and my parents, I think, did a really good job of just raising me to kind of be confident and not, you know, to be able to take criticism.
So, well, to say what you believe, which is very refreshing in the academic world, by the way.
Yeah, I know it's true. I mean, and this is something I kind of feel a little bit of a social responsibility too, because I came from a pretty humble background. My parents are both florists, and I grew up in a flower shop, and they wanted me to take over their flower shop. but instead I went to school.
Right.
And so, but my heart is sort of still there in this sort of semi-rural town in Texas. And so I'm now at this Ivy League school, and then I spent 6 years at a big university on the West Coast as well. And so I've been in kind of all these different environments, and there's not a lot of dialogue between them. So I kind of feel like it's my responsibility as a scholar and as a person who's just interested in pop culture, interested in being in the world, to have a connection with people that isn't involved in this kind of ivory tower business.
Yeah.
So a lot of
yeah.
people, you know, many of the articles I write, they're for specialists, and they end up in journals that probably end up on shelves that and collecting dust that nobody reads. And so, I mean, what is the role of the humanities? I think it's to talk about humanity.
It's to raise
and to
questions.
Connect with humanity.
Yeah, it's to raise and cause people and pose questions that people have a tough time answering, or ask people to face up to the way they're really living.
Exactly.
I love that you grew up both your parents were florists, because if you watch florists put together a thing of flowers, it takes attention to detail, and it takes finesse, and it takes a sensitive visual sensitivity to relationships and spatial relationships and all that stuff. Am I right?
Yeah, and I was terrible at it. That's why I did a French degree.
Well, what's funny though is you say here, and I just love this, and I want to read this particular thing. You say, we have gained some skill sets, multitasking, technological savvy, but other skills have suffered. The art of conversation, the art of looking at people, the art of being seen, the art of being present. Our conduct is no longer governed by subtlety, finesse, grace, and attention, all qualities more esteemed in earlier decades. Inwardness and narcissism now hold sway. And I mean, again, you're throwing out some, you know, these are strong accusations, man. And it's so great and refreshing, because there's nothing too ironic. It's pretty direct.
Yeah, I mean, who hasn't noticed? I mean, if you wait for the train, or if you're in any public space, go to any coffee shop or restaurant or whatever, and you see people just completely absorbed by their machines in their hands. I mean, what's particularly sad is when you see something like a family of four having dinner, and each person is on their phone.
Yeah.
And I find it actually incredibly sad.
Well, I always talk in my first special, I was talking about when what we've given up with texting and email when it comes to romance. Mm-hmm. You know, when I was 14, I remember I got a love letter from my first girlfriend, Karen Harrison, and I was 5,000 miles away. She was in Saudi Arabia. Now I was in the US and I was in boarding school because my parents were still overseas, and I was so lonely and I missed her so much. And she sent me a letter that she had written by hand, of course. And I recognized, of course, her cursive, and she would dot her I's with this big circle, and it smelled like her perfume. Oh, and by the way, she cried onto the letter, so the ink was running. Let me tell you, man, I was 14. I held on to that letter. I would smell it and hold it. There was some organic quality. The amount of time it took to write that letter. We've lost that to an extent. You pay a price for technology. You pay a price in intimacy, which is, I think, what you're talking about. Mm-hmm. It feels why people seem to want to go back to the earth. You go into these trendy restaurants and there's wood on the ceilings and it looks like a country kitchen. And that's the trendy restaurants, at least on the coast. Other towns too, right?
Yeah. And I mentioned there, I wanted to talk a little bit about this weird nostalgia cycle. I mentioned in the article that the nostalgia cycle has become so short that we want to actually inject the present with some kind of
That was so brilliant to me when I read that. Again, it was so humbling. When you that's Instagram. We vintage our photographs. Mm-hmm. And again, when I read that, I was like, yes, of course.
And I'm not sure if this exists yet, but I think it would be great if someone made a program that would take away those filters from photographs so you could look online at other people's photos without the filter.
Right.
And you would see how kind of banal they are in comparison.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I don't know why we're so interested in rushing that kind of nostalgia. I don't think it's rushable. I don't think you can accelerate that.
Well, you can't. You can't. But I mean, that now you might be talking about style versus substance, and we're always going to have, I mean, you know, look, a high definition television, I can tell you, is going to take care of a lot of that stuff. Now that I see myself on high def, I'm always like, oh God, who's the old creepy guy? So, you know, well, I know you've got a busy schedule, and you've really done, I think, us a service with your article and with your thoughts and with your courage. And I hope you keep doing it. I'm sure you will. Because you're a breath of fresh air, man.
I really appreciate that. And I have to say that when I someone that works with you contacted me about this interview, and I was a little bit nervous to do it because I felt like I was kind of attacking your industry.
No.
But I mean, you know, it's obvious that you know how to turn that off. So once you leave the stage, that you're a real human being under there. And I think a lot of people just have gotten so accustomed to it that they can't turn it off at all, and they don't even realize that they're responding in this kind of ironic way.
It's why I always say it's why it's so important to read and immerse yourself in the best that's been thought and said and written, because it gives you perspective. And it's very important, and I think it's sorely lacking. You know, maybe it's because I'm getting older, but I look around and people, I wonder where people draw their inspiration from. I really do. I know a lot of people that spend most of their time, if you could crack their brain open, most of what goes on in their head is Twitter, Facebook, what they're going to eat, and the gym. If you look at most magazines today, it's no longer, you know, back in the day, the housewife in Toledo was interested in what was going on in the opera scene in New York, because there was the idea was that you could reach beyond yourself. Bobby Fischer and I think Kasparov played chess, the world watched. When William Buckley would debate Noam Chomsky on Firing Line, which was a long, in-depth show where they debated really real ideas, people tuned in. There was real discussion the next day. And I think we live now in a world where it's all about niche audiences, where it's all about magazines that cater to the individual needs, your appetites and your body and the lines you cut with the latest fashions and stuff, and how to get your bone structure to cut light a little better with this makeup or this cream or this hat, right? That's what I feel you're sort of mounting the call against.
Exactly. Yeah, I just want to kind of encourage people to pay attention to that and self-reflect a little bit. I don't understand why a call to do that was so offensive to some people.
Well, listen, brilliant minds disturb. They are supposed to, and you're brilliant, man. It's really. I hope to meet you someday in person. I hope you can come to a show of mine. So, Christy, thank you so much for your time.
You're welcome.
And I recommend everybody read the article. It's called How to Live Without Irony, and it was in the Sunday Review section of the Times. You can get it. Just go to New York Times or just Google Christy Wompole and look up How to Live Without Irony. It's so important. And speaking of books, I always push a couple books. I'm reading Lawrence Lessig's book, A Republic Lost, that I recommend to everybody. It's just about how money has hijacked our government on both sides of the aisle, and how sensible policy is no longer possible with special interests. And it's an effective and good argument. So take a look at that. I will be in San Francisco at the Punchline, everybody. Let me see. I'll be in San Francisco. Hold on. I'm getting my schedule. You can tell how. Boy, am I really? I'm really prepared here, Christy. Hold. Hold, Christy. I'm not letting you go yet.
Okay.
I'll be in San Francisco at the Punchline January 16th, 17th, 18th, and 19th. Come and get some. And then I'll be at the Comedy Mix January 24th, 25th, 26th. I'm working on my new special, and everything you see will be brand new. And I'm kind of proud of it. It seems to be doing well. So I hope to see everybody there. Christy Wompole, Professor Wompole, you're the best. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much, Brian. I appreciate it.
All right. We'll talk to you later.
Bye.
You've been listening to The Brian Callen Show. Be sure to visit briancallen.com for information about this episode as well as past and future episodes. You can follow Brian on Twitter at Brian Callen and like him on Facebook. Go to facebook.com/Brian Callen Comedy. Thanks again for listening. We'll see you next time.